headlines. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories are to meet again in Vienna to revive the accord, something Tehran says requires the removal of all U.S. sanctions. The U.S. formally begins withdrawing its remaining troops from Afghanistan to end what President Biden had described as the forever war. And Kyrgyzstan accuses Tajikistan of breaching a recent ceasefire the two sides agreed on following Thursday's deadly border clashes. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to hold another round of talks aimed at reviving the accord in Vienna. The joint commission will be attended by representatives from Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the EU. The U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Robert Malley, is also present in the Austrian capital, but there will be no talks between him and Iranian negotiators. Earlier, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the nuclear talks were in, quote, an unclear place, but admitted that the sides have shown serious willingness to take a pathway back into the deal. That is while Tehran has repeatedly said that it will only accept the outcome of the talks once Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Iran has also made it clear that it would not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Our correspondent, Homolesky, has updated us regarding the negotiations in Vienna.
But we have been hearing from various sources, the voices coming from inside Iran, unnamed sources saying that Iran has a lot of demands when it comes to the sanctions that need to be removed, both on how they should be removed and both on what sanctions need to be removed. Some include executive orders. That will probably have, there'll be less trouble with that, but some of them include laws that have been passed by lawmakers, Congress. Maybe there'll be more complications when it comes to those kinds of laws, known as KATSA, the sanctions that are imposed by the U.S. on what it terms are its adversaries. And these sanctions have been targeting Iran's missile program or the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran, as well as economic entities or ISA, known as the Iran Sanctions Act, and also other financial sanctions that the U.S. has imposed by the U.S. Treasury. There has been talk that the U.S. may be only willing to temporarily suspend some of these sanctions within like 120 to 180-day intervals. We don't know if that's actually something that they have proposed, but these are just unofficial reports coming in, and as far as we know, this is not something that Iran wants to accept. They have said time and again, Mr. Arakchi himself here, that Iran wants the removal of all of the sanctions imposed after the Trump administration withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018.
The U.S. has formally begun withdrawing its remaining troops from Afghanistan. American helicopters were seen flying over Kabul and nearby Bagram Air Base as Washington geared up the pullout process. U.S. officials also confirmed that the troop withdrawal, saying that May 1st is just a continuation. American forces were scheduled to leave by May the 1st under a deal signed between the Taliban and the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The Taliban accused Washington of violating the agreement. However, the incumbent President Joe Biden has promised to end what he called the forever war. He has declared all troops will be out of Afghanistan by September. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 with his so-called war on terror slogan, but despite two decades of his presence, the U.S. failed to quell violence and ensured security in the war-torn country. Amin Alami says the U.S. troop withdrawal will leave the Taliban without the slogan of fighting for foreign occupiers that they used to justify their attacks.
It seems that with the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan, there will be no place for many issues or slogans for the Taliban, mainly for jihad, because there would be no foreign invader or there would be no foreign occupier. That is why the Afghan government and mainly the people of Afghanistan call on the Taliban to say yes to the demands of the people, that is bringing peace and stability via launching a direct negotiations between the main local players.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is disturbed by Bahraini police's use of force against a peaceful sit-in in the kingdom's main prison. Spokesperson of the organization called the violent repression in the notorious Jail prison unnecessary and misappropriate. She called on the Bahraini government to immediately launch a thorough and effective investigation into the incident. Prisoners started their sit-in on April 5 after the death of a political prisoner who was reportedly denied timely access to essential health care. Activists say the security forces used heavy-handed tactics against prisoners, beating and injuring them. The Bahraini regime faces criticisms over the situation of its prisons amid the coronavirus crisis. The appalling prison situation has also sparked protests among the families of the detainees. Palestinians have held a mass rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their support for ongoing protests in the occupied West Bank and to condemn the Israeli crackdown on Palestinians. Ruba Akram reports from Gaza.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized a mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territories.
People here in the Gaza Strip stress on their support to Palestinians in the holy city of Jerusalem al-Quds. They say they are ready to sacrifice themselves in order to defend the integrity of Palestine. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has postponed planned parliamentary elections amid a voting dispute in East Jerusalem al-Quds. Abbas opted for a delay, knowing that there would be a possible backlash. Well, that happened. The move triggered protests in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip.
The first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is, they can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote.
The Palestinian Authority's decision to delay the elections comes amid Fatah's waning popularity. Also, Hamas is expected to do well in the parliamentary elections, while Fatah's prospects have been threatened by splinter factions. This has raised questions about the reason why the vote was postponed.
The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights. But in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it will be used, it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
India set yet another global record in its daily coronavirus cases, registering more than 400,000 infections as hospitals are running out of beds, oxygen, and vaccines. The Federal Health Ministry also reported a record 3,500-plus fatalities in the past 24 hours, bringing the country's total death toll to over 211,000. The Asian nation has seen an alarming rise in cases and deaths since mid-April. Its total caseload now stands at over 19 million, second only to the U.S. On Saturday, the country expanded its vaccination drive to all adults, despite many states reporting to be running out of stocks. Until now, only frontline workers, like medical staff people over 45 and those with existing illnesses, have been inoculated. Hospitals and healthcare facilities have been overwhelmed with patients. Munawwar Zaman says that India's rollout is not well managed and has drawn large-scale criticism of the government.
The vaccination drive that was rolled out has completely failed because the vaccination was not rolled out in a proper or in a well-managed or well-mannered way, because there were lots of gaps and lots of issues with the vaccination drive. When the government said that they will start vaccinating a certain age group of people and the frontline workers, etc., it has drawn a large-scale criticism, because if we remember, when the country started vaccinating its population, it also started exporting the vaccination, which many believe was the biggest setback the country is facing right now. Well, last October, when the country thought that the virus is retreating, they started thinking that we will be the first nation to export vaccination to most of the countries. But what is right now the biggest trouble and the biggest challenge for the government is the vaccination, because they don't have the vaccine shots right now. Till now, only 9% of the population has been vaccinated.
The second wave of coronavirus pandemic continues to inflict mayhem in the Indian subcontinent. The country is battling with acute shortage of oxygen and medical supplies. The country has registered a record with more than 400,000 new cases and 3,500 new deaths. Munawar Zaman has more from New Delhi.
This is not a car parking, neither a hospital nor an ambulance waiting area, but a makeshift oxygen canteen organized by a Sikh Gurdwara in a posh South Delhi region. Here, oxygen is served free of cost for those in need for a mouthful of air. The second wave of the COVID-19 is turning lethal in India with each passing day, raising fears of more intense calamity in the coming weeks.
I don't know whose fault this is, Mr. Kejriwal's or Mr. Modi's, but you can never clap with one hand. They both have to be responsible for what is happening in New Delhi. You know there is no value for life here. A minister or a VIP will get oxygen, but a common man die.
The total number of infections has risen to nearly 18 million based on government data, but experts argue the numbers are much higher. And so are the fatalities. They accuse the government of hiding the actual picture, calling it an unprecedented calamity. It's not just the oxygen or medical supplies that are running short. Crematoriums are overflowing with COVID victims, and the families have to wait for hours to burn the bodies. Experts say the next 10 days are extremely critical for the country, as the outbreak might reach its peak. India's crumbling vaccination program has vastly been criticized, with health experts saying the drive was largely mismanaged and should have been rolled out for all, regardless of the age group. Critics also say the government's overconfidence in handling the first wave, costing and exporting the vaccination left the country in chaos. Now the world's biggest vaccine producer doesn't have enough stock to vaccinate its own population. Reports say only 9% of the people have been vaccinated so far.
No beds and no oxygen and proper supply is a complete crumbling down of the health system in India, with mismanaged systems in hospital, main hospitals like AIMS in Delhi.
The Indian government is facing unprecedented criticism over handling the crisis. Critics blame the government for allowing huge election rallies and religious gatherings, which they say added fuel to the pandemic. The country's Supreme Court on Friday directed all states against clamping down on social media, as the desperate citizens have resorted to social media for grievances. Many are also posting SOS messages for the ambulances, oxygen and medicine. The top court has further directed the government to follow the national immunization model. Moreover, the international aid has started pouring in, but experts say it's just a drop in an ocean, considering the size and population of the country. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Ask again and again. One of the required conditions for acceptance of dua is that we express them with attention. Sometimes, people might repeatedly say, with no real attention to the meaning, phrases like, O God, forgive us, O God, expand our share from your blessings, and O God, help us pay our debts. A person might say du'as like that for 10 years, but their du'as won't be accepted. You should supplicate to God and implore. You should beseech to God earnestly. Ask again and again. In this manner, God the Exalted will surely accept the du'as and realize them. Teach us too. My advice is to practice self-observation during these 3 days spent in mosques. When you speak, when you eat, socialize, read, think, or plan for the future, always prefer God's satisfaction and will over your yearnings and desires. Do not surrender to your desires. Practicing these observances during the 3 days of itikaf can be a lesson for those dear ones performing it and for us sitting here, watching our dear young ones in itikaf. Teach us with your actions.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
True awaiting. The most important responsibility of the individuals who await the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is to improve spiritual, ethical and practical aspects and to establish religious and effective bonds with the believers and also get prepared for confronting the coercive people. Those who during the sacred defense era participated in the sacred defense enthusiastically were the ones who truly awaited Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. May God hasten his return. The person who is ready to defend the values, the Islamic homeland, and the rising flag of Islam when the country is threatened by the enemies can claim that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam comes, he would follow his steps in dangerous fields. But those who are weak In face of dangers, deviations, ups and downs of the world, those who won't do anything that would put their own interests at risk can never be regarded as truly awaiting Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. A person who awaits that great Redeemer should prepare in themselves and the basis of redemption, and act in a manner so they can resist and redemption is realized.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Recent clashes between tribes in Sudan's West Darfur region have left dozens of people dead, while thousands have fled to neighboring Chad. Now, the killings are taking place after a joint peace mission to the region by the UN and the African Union ended in January. Many internally displaced persons had expressed fear that the government will not protect them after the withdrawal of international peacekeepers.
And we, as the IDPs, we are victims of the wars because we all became orphans. Our government is the one who is fighting against us.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are focusing on the endless conflict in Sudan's Darfur region. We are asking, what is the root cause of this conflict, and are foreign powers involved in the suffering of the people in Darfur? In the second part of our program, we are going to talk about how West African nations are losing hundreds of millions of dollars to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing.
Endless conflict in Sudan's Darfur. Sudan's West Darfur state has seen an upsurge in violence, with members of the Masalit and Arab communities clashing early April in the state capital, Al-Janaina. The Masalit are mainly farmers, while the Arab tribes are mainly herders, with the violence and divisions rooted in disputes over land, pasture, and water resources. To prevent the situation from spiraling out of control, Sudan's government has declared a state of emergency in the region. The vast Darfur region was ravaged by a civil war that erupted in 2003, leaving some 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced. A Sudanese refugee speaks here on life at a camp for internally displaced people. The latest clashes come after the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously last December to end the joint African Union-UN peacekeeping force in Darfur.
Following the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019, Sudan has been experiencing turbulent and fragile transition, especially in Darfur. In August of 2019, civilian political groups and military commanders reached a power-sharing agreement, charting the path for Sudan's transition. A peace deal was signed in October 2020 with a number of rebel factions, but some key armed groups are still active in Darfur. Now, to analyze the ongoing conflict in Sudan's Darfur region, We contacted Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer and journalist based in Canada. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Corrigan. Now, what is the reason behind the recent flare-up of conflict in Sudan's Darfur region?
In my opinion, it's complex. It actually goes back to the 1884 Berlin Conference, where the European colonial powers divided up Africa in a way that deliberately disrespected the sort of cultural, ethnic, and tribal boundaries. So you end up with all the states basically having a very, you know, weak state identity and tribal boundaries, which the tribe just ignores. The other problem is, since 2003, when the conflict erupted, it was exacerbated by conditions of drought, which greatly affected both the groups that have farmland and also the groups that are nomadic and have to move their herds and camels and stuff like that through the areas. There's also the suspicion that there's oil in Darfur, which means that some external actors are interested in destabilizing Sudan and perhaps getting access or control over these oil resources, which are hoped to be there.
Stay tuned for more.
The peace deal last year between some armed groups and Sudan's transitional government was touted as a historic moment, coming following the overthrow of long-serving ruler Omar al-Bashir. As part of the deal, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok appointed a veteran Darfur rebel group leader as finance minister in a cabinet overhaul amid a worsening economic crisis. Addressing the nation after the February cabinet reshuffle, Hamdok said the new cabinet came as a result of a political consensus.
This formation came after a political agreement that happened after long discussions, which took months. Its primary purpose was to save this country from collapse. As you can see, our region has many problems and challenges. Countries close and far from us have collapsed in the past years. We, as Sudanese people, will not repeat this example.
Some of the conflict-affected communities also complained that their voices have not been heard, and they expressed their reservations about the deal.
We've been in these camps since 2004. We want the conflict to end so we can go back to our harvest and to our ancestral home. But we've not been properly consulted on the deal that's taking place or represented, and so we're concerned it may not hold.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, the people in Darfur appear skeptical about the peace agreement signed last October. Now, what could be the factor behind this skepticism?
You're skeptical because there's no peace, so you still have ongoing violence, attacks by the various groups against each other, and you have militia going around attacking and raping people, and so you have a very weak government in Darfur, and they don't have the ability to impose order themselves, and the central government in Sudan doesn't have the ability to put peacekeeping efforts and force to provide security for Darfur. So the situation is reverting to what it was before the peace agreement in October 2020.
Well, thanks for that insight, Mr. Corrigan.
The African Union United Nations Hybrid Operation in Darfur, referred to by its acronym UNAMID, was established on 31st of July 2007 with the adoption of a UN Security Council resolution. On December 31st last year, UNAMID formally ended its operations in the region. People in Darfur protested the departure of the UN peacekeepers at the time, citing fears of renewed violence. Let's take a listen.
We, as the IDPs, we are victims of the wars because we all become orphans. Our government is the one who is fighting against us. Before UNAMID, or I will say in the presence of UNAMID, attack us in the camp more than three times. So that is why we see, if in the presence of UNAMID, the government of Sudan and the militia, I would say Janjaweed, are attacking us.
Now, has the withdrawal of UN and African Union peacekeeping troops contributed to the absence of violence, and should these troops be reinstated?
Yes, the withdrawal of the troops who served as a peacekeeping force and also as a buffer between the various competing tribal groups and political groups have, you know, withdrawn, so that this has created a problem. And yes, I think as a transition, it's probably a good idea to have UN forces, and in particular the African Union forces, coming in a genuine effort to bring security for the region, separate the boundaries, and to help build some civil and political institutions that can restore order and maintain peace.
Now, many people in Darfur are in dire need of assistance, but funding for relief efforts has dwindled. Thousands of displaced people are living in overcrowded makeshift camps. What's the humanitarian situation in Darfur now?
Well, in Darfur, it's a disaster. There's a drought, there's a huge shortage of water, shortage of food, and some people describe it as the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. Yemen is also described as the worst humanitarian disaster on the planet. So, you know, to say that Yemen and Darfur are competing is not a very good thing, because both are terrible. But there is a lack of resources. The UN, the Western powers, are not putting the food and money needed into sort of, you know, help protect people. And they need to invest in building political and civil infrastructure that can look after the people's interests. And that's not happening. So yes, the situation in Darfur is a disaster, and it's only going to get worse. And it's an ongoing part of the shifting climate in the area, and the expansion of the deserts and drought. So this is all part of climate change that is having a devastating impact on the people of Darfur and also people in other parts of Africa.
Well, thanks, Mr. Corrigan. Well, it's quite interesting there to note that climate change is also a source of conflict in Darfur and indeed other parts of Africa. Now, before we wind up, Mr. Corrigan, is the transitional authority in Khartoum able to restore peace in Darfur?
They are trying to get involved in Darfur, but again, they're relying upon the old tribal alliances, and that is not going to solve the problem, but probably in the short term exacerbate them. And what you need is sort of a more unified civil identity that will bring the various groups in Darfur and Sudan together in a way that is acceptable. As I said, because of the division of Africa by the European powers in 1884 in the Berlin Conference, you know, every African state, quite frankly, is unstable. As a result, you've got, you know, weak states with a very fluid sort of, you know, social and cultural and political environment that moves. So, you know, every African state basically has political problems which they've inherited from the colonial period and haven't been able to overcome them.
Mr. Corrigan there says that most of the conflicts in Africa are the result of boundaries imposed by colonial powers. Now, let us know what you think about that perspective through our social media handle. Now, we're going to take a short break, and in the next part of this week's edition of Africa Today, we shall look at how Europe's fishing fleets are wreaking havoc in West Africa. Don't go away.
Europe's dark fishing fleets threaten West Africa.
Cargo battleships from around the world are moving untracked in African waters, where the rise of illegal and unregulated fishing activity affects everything from local biodiversity to piracy.
According to a report by ENT website, West Africa is a hotspot for what is known in the industry as illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says West African nations lose $2.3 billion each year to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. The 5,500 kilometers coastline of West Africa is home to some of the most diverse fisheries in the world. Local fishermen are worried that if this trend of illegal and unregulated fishing continues, there will be no more fish left for future generations.
For more on this subject, we contacted Dr. Efesinechi Okefuria-Rood, a lecturer in sustainable development at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Okefuria-Rood. Now, to start off, first tell us, how serious is this problem of illegal fishing in West African waters by European fishing companies?
Thank you so much for the question. Illegal fishing by foreign vessels is a very big problem. And just to give you a bit of a statistics to get a general idea of how big the problem is, it amounts to the equivalent of 40 to 65% of illegally reported catch in West Africa alone. And then going beyond the illegal fishing, there's also a problem of legal fishing itself, which obviously is sort of exacerbating the extent to which fisheries resources is depleting. And by legal fishing, I mean the continued targeting of species that are already overexploited. So all these things are some of the issues that contribute to depletion of fish stock. And I wouldn't necessarily want to say that it is only European vessels, because unfortunately, Asian vessels are also complicit.
Now, citizens of countries affected by illegal and unregulated fishing blame their governments for failing to invest in sustainable fisheries as a way to build resilience and improve the livelihoods of coastal communities.
It's down to human greed. We local fishermen are partly to blame, but it's also our government's fault allocating fishing rights to foreign industrial vessels. They act like pirates pillaging our ocean's resources. This needs to stop.
The populations of West Africa, home to one of the world's most resource-rich marine environments, is suffering widespread poverty and a scarcity of legitimate livelihoods, in part due to high levels of foreign illegal fishing and overfishing. A Senegalese fish seller here says lack of fish is affecting her livelihood. How has the illegal and unregulated fishing by foreign fishing companies contributed to the rising levels of poverty and unemployment in the region?
The implication of illegal fishing is absolutely devastating for countries in West Africa and their people. Just to give you a bit of statistics, each year, just for six West African countries, Mauritania, Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, they lose an estimated $2.3 billion to illegal fishing each year. And obviously, the amount that they lose is likely to be more due to the clandestine nature of this crime, means that it is practically impossible to put an amount to it. And so this is the loss to the nations. Imagine, therefore, the impact it has on the people that actually depend on this resource for subsistence. Their food security is undermined. Their income security is also undermined.
Illegal and unregulated fishing also harms the marine environment and leads to depletion of fish supply. Some fishing methods, such as dredging and bottom trawling, also impact the seafloor habitat. What's the extent of environmental impact on illegal fishing?
The environmental impact of illegal fishing is very devastating for countries in West Africa, especially when you take into account the impact of climate change and the impact of pollution in the region already. And so it means that The fact that vessels engaging in illegal fishing are actually able to discard species that they catch, by discard I mean throw it back in the ocean, this leads to pollution because it creates or it results to an oxygen dead zone. These are zones that are oxygen deprived, which means that marine life cannot thrive in these areas. And so illegal fishing is absolutely a problem due to the pollution in terms of this oxygen dead zone that I've talked about, but also the fact that vessels engaging in illegal fishing sometimes discard their nets to avoid detection. It obviously undermines the sustainability of the ocean environment in those ways through pollution.
The European Union has fishing agreements with individual African nations for legal fishing rights. However, even where the EU pays a set amount annually to the host country for fishing rights, the amount paid is peanuts compared to the value of the fish.
Now, these agreements are questionable because they promote the export of African marine resources into the EU to the detriment of local economies and food security. European governments are clearly aware of companies in their countries that are engaged in unsustainable fishing to satisfy Europe's appetite for fish. Now, why have they failed to take action to stop these acts of impunity?
It's really baffling because the reality is that, I mean, in recent time, there's this global conversation around putting an end to harmful subsidy, because this is a subsidy that allows or enables distant water fishing vessels to go to third countries or countries like those in West Africa to exploit species, either targeting already overexploited species legally or engaging in illegal fishing. I mean, and not stopping or putting an end to these subsidies, which obviously mean that for them, it's more or less about their own respective national interests than ensuring the sustainability of the marine resources or even the livelihood of the countries where these illegal acts are affected.
Very unfortunate indeed that greed by rich industrialized countries is leading to increased levels of poverty in these West African countries. As we have seen there, illegal and unregulated fishing in West Africa is a major challenge in the region, threatening livelihoods, nutritional security, export revenues, and destroying the environment.
Addressing the 10th Conference of Ministers and the 10th anniversary of the Fisheries Committee for the West Central Gulf of Guinea in 2017, Nigerian Vice President Professor Yemi Osinbajo outlined some of his government's plans aimed at stopping illegal and unregulated fishing.
To this end, President Buhari has approved the purchase of some vessels for the Department of Fisheries, some patrol vessels for the Department of Fisheries, which will be managed in collaboration with the Nigerian Navy. These vessels will boost the search and rescue capacities of the relevant security agencies, deter illegal fishing, prevent illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, and help secure our vessels at sea.
Now, our last question, Dr. Aka Foriarud. What needs to be done to safeguard the West African waters?
What needs to be done is for African countries to actually work together. Something that we already, an example of how countries or regions can collaborate or cooperate around fisheries agreement, for instance, should they decide to go that route, is something that Pacific island nations have, where they negotiate this agreement as a bloc. In the context of West Africa, we already have the Economic Community of West African States. So perhaps they can come together as a bloc as well and negotiate fisheries agreements in a way that if they decide to continue with this approach as a way of economic development, they are then better able to ensure that they negotiate better deal as a bloc and also ensure that the interest of the communities where the species are extracted from is protected. And by this, I also mean that there is need for better transparency around this agreement.
Well, Dr. Okafori-Arwood there says that unity of African countries and transparency is key to stopping illegal and unregulated fishing that is impacting negatively on communities. Now, what's your opinion? Let's know what you think through our social media handle. Well, our time is up for today. On behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Please stay with us. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of the holy month of Ramadan, and what do we do to really take full advantage of this holy month of Ramadan? Now, dear listeners, it's great to have you with us. Let's go ahead and start off with something that the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Islam, peace and blessings upon him, has said as far as welcoming the holy month of Ramadan. The Holy Prophet says, O people, the days of the holy month of Ramadan are the best of days, and the nights of the holy month of Ramadan are the best of nights. And the hours of the holy month of Ramadan are the best of hours. This is a month in which you have been invited by Allah. It's very beautiful, dear brothers and sisters. Sometimes we don't really value the value of the holy month of Ramadan. We underestimate the value of this holy month. We don't really realize the beautiful blessings and the mercies and the forgiveness which is within the holy month of Ramadan. In the hustle and bustle of life, sometimes we tend to forget that this month is full of forgiveness. It's full of material, worldly, and spiritual benefits for every single one of us. In the hustle and bustle of life, we forget that the days of the holy month of Ramadan are the best of days in the whole year. Its nights are the best of nights in the whole year. Its hours are the best of hours in the whole year. One of the things which we really need to do in the holy month of Ramadan, dear friends, is this concept of forgiveness. It is istighfar. the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the Imams of the Ahl al-Bayt, the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon them all, very, very much emphasize the need to do istighfar, and especially in this holy month of Ramadan, because in this month, forgiveness is so much more easier to attain than any other month. The Holy Prophet says, unfortunate is the person who is deprived of the forgiveness of Allah during this great month of Ramadan. And furthermore, the Holy Prophet says, whoever is not forgiven, God forbid, in the holy month of Ramadan, then in which month will they be forgiven? May Allah forgive every single one of us for the sake of the holy month of Ramadan.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
We thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We glorify Him. All praise is always due to Him for this gift of the month of Ramadan and this unique month this year, the month of isolation and seclusion and our normal community routine that a lot of us have been used to for many, many years is no longer here this year. But there is a silver lining to this pandemic, and there is a path to be carved back to Allah, no doubt. And part of that is that this is a golden opportunity for us to build together as a family unit, strengthen our marriages, bond with our children, look after our parents, et cetera, in this month of Allah. How many people now asking me about, is this the apocalypse, end of times, Iman al-Zamana, what will happen, what do I need to do to get my family ready, all these things. So yes, even if we are to accept the fact this is a pandemic and people are dying, it's a very grim time to be alive right now, to watching this entire global village now struggle to keep this virus away from them. It's difficult to watch. It's scary now to turn on the news. At the same time, it is an awakening for us. And if we can take it as the language of God, then yes, sometimes He talks to us through our hardships. The language of God is through tribulation. The zaban of Allah are through the sakhti and the hardships that we go through. He's trying to tell us something. He's trying to send a message to us, awaken us from our deep sleep. The example I've given before, and it fits right now, the month of Ramadan, is, you know, growing up, I remember, I used to be a very deep sleeper. Okay, now not so much. Now I'm quite light. But before I used to be a deep, and I'll end with this, I used to be a deep sleeper. And my father, marhum, would come wake me up for suhoor, for sahri. Okay, and it was very difficult for me to wake up, very hard. So he would come, and God bless him, he'd come 2, 3, 4 times. And he could tell, I'm buried under my blanket, I'm out cold, I found my spot, I found that groove in the blanket, you know, the cold, the hot, just a beautiful, sweet spot inside the bed. But he would not let up. He would not let up. He'd wake me up. I come staggering down, one eye open, barely finish my Honey Nut Cheerios, and go back upstairs until Fajr. And he would tell me, he said, look, sometimes I feel bad waking you up. You look so comfortable. But I didn't want you to miss Sahri and then miss Fajr. Meaning there was a higher purpose that was beyond your comfortable sleep. So sometimes I had to wake you up and jolt you and pull the blanket. Some days he would come and pull the blanket off of me. And that was mean. But it had to be done, because the thought of him